Oh, it's so good to be with y'all. Actually, originally, I was not going to be here in person today. My oldest is in eighth grade, and he was on a basketball team, and they made the state tournament. Well, we got beat. And so we went and won a game and lost a game and then opted not to play our bonus game, which is just like, hey, you drove all this way. And so I actually have videoed this sermon ahead of time, and it's a better sermon than what I'm going to give you, I think. I often walk away, and I never really walk away from a Sunday going, that was really good, because the evangelicals taught me to hate myself so well that I never like really get to just feel that way. But I finished the video and I was, the other day, and I was like, you know what? That's not a bad sermon. And then I was a little disappointed driving in today, because I was like, they'll never hear that one that wasn't bad. So I'm really excited about where we're at. We're in the Gospel of Mark. We're in a series called Good News at the End of the World. Now, this is not the end of the world in the way people talk about the end of the world. It's the end of the world for Mark and his community, for around the year 70, when the Romans destroyed Jerusalem and destroyed the temple. And for them, for people who lived in that place, for people who were attached to that temple, for people who were attached to that way of being, their world ended in pretty cataclysmic fashion. And Mark is writing this gospel, and gospel means good news. Mark is writing a good news story in the aftermath, sifting and sorting through the rubble at the end of the world, insisting that somehow connected to this person that he calls Jesus, that there is still, even in the middle of everything going haywire, there's still some good news to be found. And we've been exploring how Jesus sort of launches this kingdom of God movement. And that Jesus' insistence in Mark is that the kingdom of God, the dream of God, the kingdom of God, whatever language you want to use for it, is not somewhere else, somewhere else, for someone else, but that this kingdom, this dream is here, it is now, and it is accessible to anyone and everyone who wants to participate. All that is asked of us is that we have a change of thinking. Because in order to fully engage and participate in it, we have to change how we think about what God is like, about who we are and what we're like, about our neighbors, about our enemies. It requires this radical shift in seeing the world differently. And so we've been talking about what that means and how we do that. And each week, if this is your first week joining us, each week we sort of we're doing an overview of a chapter, and then we sit down, focus on a story, a theme. I said we weren't going to cover the whole chapter a couple weeks ago. That happened. Sorry about that. But there's just so much here, and it's so rich. So a quick overview of Mark chapter 7, which is where we are. Verses 1 through 23, there's a controversy about tradition and purity that Jesus engages with the Pharisees. Then in 24 through 30, he heals the daughter of a Gentile woman. That's our story we're going to really focus on today. 31 through 37, he heals a deaf man. But I do want to make some comments real quick on 1 through 23. And that's because this story where Jesus and the Pharisees engage in this debate about purity, specifically around food and unwashed hands and all that, this sort of becomes a caricature of Judaism that isn't reality. And it ends up being used in anti-Semitic ways to sort of paint a picture of Judaism that is not grounded in history, not grounded in reality. So it's really important to, first of all, acknowledge that this is not a debate and discussion between Jesus, founder of a new religion called Christianity, and the Pharisees who are part of Judaism. That's not what's happening here. Jesus was, lived, died, the whole thing, thoroughly Jewish. That never changed. It didn't change for his followers. It didn't change for Paul. That begins to happen later as the church spreads to non-Jewish territory, which we're going to talk a little bit about today. So first of all, they were all Jewish. Second, what we see here, a guy named Richard Horsley, a scholar, is somebody who really brought this out in one of his books called Hearing the Whole Story, which is on the Gospel of Mark. But he points out that what we're seeing here is kind of a regional debate and a regional discussion and argument. And here's what he says. How many of you are aware that in the United States of America in 2024, there is sort of a regional divide between rural and urban? Are you aware of this? Everybody's like, yes, we're aware. There's sort of a way of seeing life and living life and approaching life in the rural area that often is in conflict with what's happening in urban areas. The same thing was true in the ancient world. That's not a new invention. And actually what we see is Jesus lived in a region called the Galilee, which was north of Jerusalem, away from the temple. And things in Galilee would have been different because they didn't have the same expectations and pressures. For example, if you live nowhere near the temple, and purity is primarily, and this is just what it was, primarily about worshiping in the temple. If you're impure, you have to become pure to enter into the temple. But if you don't live anywhere near the temple, are you so much worried about purity laws? Because it's not like you're just going to be walking down the street some Tuesday afternoon and go, I feel like going to the temple. You're nowhere near the temple. And so they would just have seen and understood purity laws differently just because of where they lived. And because they didn't necessarily agree on even what the Torah was. We have this idea that the Old Testament, the Hebrew Scriptures just existed, but the full canon wasn't finalized until the year 100 CE, after the life of Jesus. Like if in the life of Jesus, in the life of Paul, all these people, they were aware of texts, but there was no canon. And even at this period of time, they would have, different parts of the law would have been privileged in different regions. Right, so in Jerusalem, where the temple aristocracy is, you're going to privilege priestly texts because it's about how we do business in the temple. But if you're in Galilee, you're not going to be worried about. You might be worried because you're in a rural area and there are people from the city coming and collaborating with Rome and buying up all the land so that you can't even feed your family. You're probably not going to gravitate toward texts about having clean hands. You're probably going to gravitate toward texts about pure hearts. You're going to gravitate toward texts about justice. And I think what's happening in these 23 verses is what Jesus is saying, and there's a parenthetical comment that Jesus declared all foods clean by saying this, but y'all, I gotta tell you, when you dig into the Greek on that, that's a way of interpreting and translating that text, but it's not the only way that can be rendered. I don't think the historical Jesus ever stood up and said, you know what, everything's clean, eat it up. I just don't think that ever happened. Jesus, I think, would have still understood the importance of their kosher experience. But what Jesus is doing is he's saying, look, you're spending a lot of your time worried about what you're putting into your body making you unclean. Here's the problem. What's coming out of you is injustice. You're producing impurity because in this text, you are more concerned about checking off all the boxes than you are about caring for your parents who are ailing and elderly. Right, so this is not a text about ultimately who's washing their hands and whether or not, and by the way, washing their hands wasn't about hygiene, right? It wasn't like, well, we got Purell. It was not what they were into. So this text ultimately is about Jesus pushing back on privileging certain things over doing justice, right? It would be what Amos was doing when Amos said, was speaking for the divine and said, I'm sick of your worship songs. I'm sick of your worship experiences. Let justice roll like a river. Jesus isn't somewhere inventing a new thing called the wheel. He is actually just bringing forward what has always been in the tradition. Are you with me? So that's your mini sermon on those 23 verses. And now we're going to jump in. And I've got to tell you, this text, Mark 7, 24 through 30, maybe one of my all-time favorite texts in the entire Bible. It is definitely one of my favorite stories of Jesus. When I start telling this story to you, you're going to have questions about me as a person because I like this story. And I need you just to hang with me because this story on the front end doesn't look good for Jesus. It doesn't put Jesus in a good light. It doesn't make him seem like a really good guy. It makes Jesus seem, you're gonna have some, if you've never heard this story, buckle up. You're gonna have some problems with Jesus. Now here's what's gonna happen. We're gonna see this story, connect it to some other things. And then what you're gonna realize is, no, we still have a problem with what Jesus does here, but it's really, really good news for us that Mark includes the story because it gives us an invitation at the end. So try to hang with me. Don't bail out when you see how awful what Jesus says in this story is. So is anybody familiar with this story? Okay, so you know what's coming. Yeah. It's bad, Lee. Here we go. Mark 7, verse 24. From there, Jesus set out and went away to the region of Tyre. He entered a house and did not want anyone to know he was there. All morning, I have resisted the urge to make a dad joke about Michelin every time I talk about the region of Tyre. I want to show you a map. Thank you. Here's a map of Israel in the first century. How many of you can see the green shade on this? Okay, this is the Galilee region. This is the Sea of Galilee, which was also called Sea of Tiberias. This is all, everything you see in green here is Jewish territory, where the predominant population is Jewish, which means kosher, purity laws, all of those sorts of things. This is Tyre. Can you see the color of this map? It's not green, is it? Which means Jesus has left predominantly Jewish area. He's gone north to a coastal town, and he's in a place that is no longer Jewish, which means it is Gentile territory, which means Jesus is, he ain't from around here, right? Like these are not his people. There are all sorts of things that go into play here. This is unclean territory. It's not kosher territory. But for some reason, Jesus has decided he's going to take a trip north, and he's going to do this as a way of getting, I think, a little R&R just in this. I mean, he goes to a beach town. Why else do you go to a beach town unless you're looking for some R&R? But he goes and he enters a house. So it's not like he's just camping out. He apparently has a connection. He enters a house and he doesn't want anyone to know he's there. Question. How many of you are really good at stalking, not in an uncomfortable way, celebrities? Anybody? Like anybody just like, you know, so here's, it's not a thing for me, but a year ago, November, I had a ticket to Bono's book tour at the Ryman. And Bono, if you know me, you know U2 is, I love them. And I love Bono. And so I decided, here's what I'm going to do. I'm just going to go sit at Fifth and Broad and maybe have some dinner. But really what I'm doing is I'm watching the Ryman and I'm looking for like black SUVs to just start pulling in. And then I'm going to, I don't know, rappel down. I don't know. The plan was foggy from there. But I'm going to have my one-on-one with Bono. It did not happen. Some people apparently did. I don't know what they knew that I didn't. But I know people who just managed to go to anywhere, a sporting event, a concert, walking down the street, and they somehow walk away with a picture with a celebrity or they have an autograph from a celebrity. I've always been really, really terrible at that. Jesus has an opposite problem. He's really bad at dodging the paparazzi. Everywhere he goes in Mark, he's looking, he's like been busy, he's been expending energy, he's been liberating and healing, and everywhere he goes, he's putting out energy. And there are these moments where he's like, I just need to unplug and relax. And it seems like the moment he does, he like gets off the boat in a deserted region, and there are like 5,000 people hanging out waiting to see him. And so he thinks now, I've left the territory where they know me. I've left the place where they care about who I am, and now I can really just relax. But he could not escape notice. A woman whose little daughter had an unclean spirit immediately heard about him, and she came and bowed down at his feet. Now, the woman was a Gentile of Syro-Phoenician origin. So she's a Gentile, this woman. She's not Jewish. She's from there. She's not from where Jesus is from. What's interesting, too, is Matthew records this story. And we've talked about how Matthew incorporates 90% of Mark. Mark was a big source for Matthew. He uses almost all of it. Copyright laws did not exist. So Mark incorporates all this. What's fascinating is not that Matthew incorporates Mark. What's really interesting is when Matthew changes Mark, when Matthew alters what Mark says. Because you know that Matthew wants us, he either is trying to make his own point or he's trying to emphasize something maybe he thinks we're going to miss. Matthew does not call her Syro-Phoenician. Matthew calls her Canaanite. He says she's a Canaanite woman. There's a problem with this. Canaanites didn't exist in Jesus' day. They weren't around. It was archaic. It was anachronistic. They just didn't exist. And so Matthew makes this change. So just file that away in your short-term memory because we're going to come back to that. It actually, Matthew's doing us a favor there. He's helping amplify what Mark's trying to do. And then it's important just to notice that this woman is breaching protocol, cultural protocol, in numerous ways. One, in a patriarchal society, she is a woman who is unknown and unrelated to Jesus, which means the idea that she would approach him in any way would have been way out of bounds. Number two, she's a Gentile, which means her simple interaction with Jesus could perhaps make him unclean, just her presence in the room, right? And so there's this tension there, like she's a Gentile who's approaching this Jewish person. And then she's interrupting his privacy. Anybody else have this problem that it feels like sometimes at your house whenever you do this? Somebody says, Dad! You're like, there's no dad here. Dad is that is Calgon, take me away at the moment. That is not available. Anybody have that? Like, it feels like the moment you're trying to shut it down a little and relax, there's a new thing that pops up to do. And so Jesus is trying to unwind a bit. And then this woman enters. She's not bumping into him on the street. She's not at Fifth and Broad watching the alleyway behind the Ryman. She's entering a private residence and sort of just coming up to Jesus and essentially saying, I need help. So what it seems like to me is Jesus has left Jewish territory where they have a big problem called Rome, where Jesus's movement is not a religious movement to get out of here, but it is a religious, political, economic movement to transform the world and to offer an alternative version of society. This is what it could be. And so he leaves Jewish territory, and what he bumps into is the fact that, guess what? Gentiles have a Rome problem too. And here's what I mean by that. If you recall in the Gospel of Mark, we talked about this idea of unclean spirits. Now, I realize that people are passionate about whatever they believe about how literal demons are and how metaphorical they are. I'm not wading into that for you today. Believe whatever you want about that. I think Mark, a person in the ancient world, definitely believed in that sort of thing. I don't think Mark is telling us stories about unclean spirits in order to tell us, look what can happen to you. I think as we looked at in chapter 5 with the story of Legion, where the guy's possessed by the Legion, right, which is really on the nose for Mark as a way of saying that for him, symbolically in his gospel, unclean spirits are representative of empire, specifically the way empire colonizes and uses violence to enforce their colonization project, right? And so this little girl is not Jewish, but she's got an unclean spirit. Rome is impacting other people, not just Jews in the Galilee or Jews in Palestine. It is there are other people groups who are being equally impacted by Roman domination and Roman colonization. As Rome comes in to take over and snuff out indigenous cultures, people are being impacted. Verse 26, she begged him to cast the demon out of her daughter. Are y'all ready? If you don't know this story, don't read ahead. It's rough. She comes to Jesus and asks for help for her daughter. Here's Jesus' response. Let the children be fed first. It is not fair to take the children's food and throw it to the what? The dogs. This woman comes, please help my daughter. She's got this unclean, please help my daughter. And Jesus looks at her and just says, look, the children are gonna eat first because it's really not fair to throw the children's bread to the dogs. You get the implication here, right? Who are the children? Us. Who are the dogs? Them. This is the language of dehumanization. Does it make you feel any better to know that in Greek, the word Jesus uses for dog is like puppy? Or little dog? Because it is. He's not saying you're Great Danes, right? He's like, no, it's not right to throw the children's bread to the puppies. Yeah, it didn't help me at all either, because it's still the language of dehumanization. This woman comes to him desperate for help, and he essentially says to her, you and your daughter aren't as important as what we have going on over here. What's happening to us matters more than what's happening to you, so we're going to take you and your daughter, we're going to put you on the back burner, and maybe someday we'll get to you. Anybody else really find that problematic? So many of you know, those of you who are around in person know that we have a daughter named Ava who has spina bifida. And so you might see her on Sunday zooming around here in her blue wheelchair. You have to watch her. She will run over you. It's a problem sometimes. And as a result of having spina bifida, she has some other things. Like she has a shunt. And when she first came to live with us, just before she turned a year old, she had to have a shunt revision because her shunt messed up. And so we kind of always live, when Ava's mood changes or when her engagement changes, we always have this, like, is her shunt malfunctioning? What's going on? Last August, there was this day where everything was fine. It was after school. Everything was fine. And all of a sudden, Ava, we told her, like, hey, go upstairs and we're going to get you ready for bed. And so she goes upstairs and we go up there and she's just acting odd. She can't follow like simple instructions. Like, hey, just go over there and get your, you know, go get your pajamas or whatever. And then she starts just staring off, and she's just being really weird. And so we start asking questions, and she doesn't know who she is. She doesn't know who we are. We think, oh my gosh, her shunt's malfunctioning. What do we do? And then she goes into a full-blown seizure, which she had never done before. And so she's laying in the bathroom floor. It's a small bathroom. She's laying in the floor. We pick her up as it starts and put her on the bed, and it was terrifying. We'd never experienced that before. My oldest had a febrile seizure when he was little, but that's like your fever goes up too fast and it's not something you have to, we just didn't know what this was. And so I pick up the phone and I immediately dialed 911. And I'm talking to the person and I'm asking for help and I'm explaining what's happened and all of the stuff that goes on with Ava. And I get why. I listen to any true crime fans, you listen to podcasts all the time and it worries your friends. Like, what are you really up to? And so I get why, you listen to the 911 calls on true crime and the people are so annoyed with the 911 operators, right? Because they're asking questions. They're like, it's not important. Just send someone to the house. It's like, what color shirt is she wearing? Not relevant. Just send someone to the house. And it felt like it took like an hour for them to get there. And it really took about 10 minutes. But she had this seizure for over half an hour at least. They couldn't get her sats back up. And so they were going to airlift her. And even then, like, it just took a long time because her oxygen was down in the low 70s. And it was just a really, really scary, scary thing for us. And we found out now that she has epilepsy. And so she's on some medicine. She's had a couple small seizures since, nothing like that. And we manage it and keep an eye on her, watch her like a hawk, helicopter the whole experience. I'm just trying to imagine what it would be like to call 911 saying my daughter is in need of emergency help. And they would just say, look, there are just more important people. There are more important people who are having a medical emergency right now. Or there may be other people who have an emergency. So we want to keep everything like ready to go for somebody else who's more important than your family, who matters more, who's more like me. Do you see? I promise you, I wouldn't have been trying to get off the phone with 911. They would have been trying to get off the phone with me, right? Because if you're a parent, you know this deep in your bones, whether your kid's having a physical emergency or they hit that age where you can no longer make everything okay and they're dealing with emotions and relationships and their friends are actually kind of mean people and you can no longer just make things right, right? But there's this sense of like you're just desperate for help and you're just looking for anybody who can provide you any sort of insight, resource, help, context. Imagine that person looks at you and said, there are more important people in the world. And then you're in the shoes of this mother who's heard the rumors about this Jesus of Nazareth who has power over the unclean spirits. They know him and they fear him in a way. And he comes to your town and you have an opportunity to get your daughter the help she needs. And his response to you is to call you and your daughter a dog. Yeah, that's a rough story, isn't it? It's a rough story. And apologists have really struggled with this story because it really gives us an image of Jesus that we're uncomfortable with. So what do we do with a Jesus who seems to say something that is so terrible? And so some have said, well, maybe Jesus was just testing his disciples because in Matthew, they actually say to him, Jesus, will you please tell her to be quiet? She's annoying us. And Jesus is like, please be quiet. You're annoying us. So maybe what is happening here is Jesus is testing the disciples to see what they're going to do. Or maybe Jesus is testing this woman to really see what kind of faith she has. Can I just ask you a question? Does that make it any better? Do you feel better about it if Jesus is like, at the end, like, look, this was all just a test? Can you imagine if I called 911? They're like, yeah, we'll send an ambulance, but first we have three riddles that you have to solve. Like, I'm sorry, are you hanging out by a bridge trying to stop me from passing, or are you going to send help? Right? Like, that's sort of like the Jesus who sees a situation like this and is like, this is a great opportunity for me just to ask some questions to try to figure out what people would do. As if we're lab rats. And Jesus is the master scientist who's seeing which way will they go and what will they do. I don't think that solves anything. I think it's equally problematic in ways. The Jesus who tests us to see what we'll do. Here's what I think was happening. I think Jesus, in many ways, was not a person of his day. He had a vision that was grounded in this sense of justice for his people. But in other ways, I think Jesus was a first century person of his day. And I think he'd been shaped by the norms and biases that he had been raised with. I think Jesus had been raised his entire life to look at Gentiles as other, as outside, as unclean, as unworthy, as beneath. And so in this moment, when he has the opportunity to encounter somebody, his biases kick into place. Has this ever happened for any of us? As for me, still does in different ways, right? I think what we're seeing here is Jesus is a real flesh and blood human being, a product of his time and place in context. And he essentially gives this woman the party line. We're the children, you're the dogs. Maybe we'll get around to you eventually, but right now it's time for the kids to eat. And notice what she does next. But she answered him. And I you don't know what Mark intends. Mark is a short gospel. It's very quick moving. Everything happens fast. But it's like she didn't even flinch. She didn't go like, I'm going to go away and come back and I'm going to have a great zinger for this guy. I'm going to go home and prepare. And next time I see him somewhere, I'm going to bust him. It's like she immediately just says back to him, sir, even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs. You know what we would call her today? We would call her a mama bear, yeah. Right? We would call her a mama bear. We would call her this fierce, courageous, passionate person who refuses. It's almost like she says this, like, oh, okay. You want to call us dogs and dehumanize us? Fine. Let's work within your metaphor. Even the dogs eat the children's crumbs. So you guys are better than us? Great, you're better than us. You're more important than us? Great, you're more important than us. But like while you're munching down, can we at least scrape up some crumbs? Can we at least get in on a little bit of what's left over? I mean, what a response. She doesn't walk away just angry and, you know, she doesn't like, I'm gonna Facebook review this guy. Like that's not at all. Watch out for this false teacher from Nazareth. Like not at all. Her response, I know something about that. It is not at all what she does. She has this built-in response. Okay, fine, whatever. Heap on the insult. But while you're heaping on the insult, will you allow me to scrape up some crumbs so that my daughter can be okay? This is creative. It is gutsy. It's courageous. And Jesus says to her immediately, like, boom. It's like she has this built-in response, and now here's Jesus' involuntary response. For saying that, you may go. The demon has left your daughter. And she went home and found the child lying in bed and the demon gone.
Amen, brother.
Yeah, Jesus is stopped in his tracks. The record scratches. It's like, whoa, what? I said that and you said that? Something happens here. She changes Jesus' understanding of Gentiles. To use Jesus' own metaphor, she is new wine expanding Jesus' wineskin. Because even Jesus had to keep a fresh one around. She's pushing back on the biases that he had inherited, on the boundaries that he had known. She is asking him. You can tell in the beginning of his story, he doesn't see her. It's almost like a flip of the hand and a looking the other way. And it's like this, no, she is demanding to be seen. She is demanding her daughter to be seen. She will not take no for an answer. She will accept crumbs if that's what it takes, but she's not going home empty handed. In this story, Jesus is changed by this experience. He's changed by the experience of another human being. He learns something new, he changes his mind, and it alters the direction of Mark, and it alters the direction of what would become the church. This moment is a pivot moment. It is a transformative moment in the ministry of Jesus. And the Jesus movement, now I don't know if this story is literal or not, I don't know, but here's what I do know. I know that the Jesus movement through the work of people like Paul, that's who we know about, there are other people we don't know about, I'm sure. I think what they began to understand is that it's not just us Jews in Palestine who have a Rome problem. It's also all the Gentiles around us too. What if this vision of a different world, what if we all got together and worked together? What if we were able to put some of our differences aside And instead, envision a world where people aren't oppressed and where injustice doesn't reign, where people can feed their families and where people don't have to live under the threat of Roman crucifixion, where people can thrive and flourish. What if Gentiles ultimately want the same thing we do? And that is just to be able to flourish as human beings. So what if we created communities, not that we're really boundaried where it kept people out, but what if we started creating communities where we started getting all these people who are really, really different together in the same place? And maybe that's how we'll know that God is among us. Because we'll bring people together who worship many gods, and we'll bring people together who don't eat pork and people who do, and we'll bring people together who celebrate this holiday, and we'll bring people together who think that holiday is just superstition. We'll just bring all these people together. By the way, if you try to read Paul's letters through this, his authentic letters, they actually make sense. Paul's not writing systematic theologies. Here's what Paul's doing. Every letter, I think, even Romans, he's writing to communities where Jews and Gentiles are trying to make a go of it together, to enact this kingdom of God together. And he's writing to them, and he's trying to help them find ways to move past all the myriad things that would divide them into the place where they can be united, which is a vision of the world where everybody gets to flourish. That is the New Testament in about 60 seconds. I think that's what they were really doing. And in this lens, it begins with this experience of Jesus, of another human being. How many of you in here have changed your theology and thoughts on anything over the past 20, 30 years? Throw up a hand. Okay, that's about what I expected in this room. You know what happened for me? It wasn't that I was wearing a tweed blazer, reading books in a library, drinking tea, and suddenly realized I've been wrong about all this. Do you know what it was time and again? It was walking around with a deeply homophobic heart. And then a friend coming out to me and knowing that this person loved God dearly and that this made no sense within the worldview I'd been given, but I don't know how to not affirm the divine I've met in them. And so that I could no longer carry around bigotry. It's sort of like that moment in Acts when Peter sees the Spirit fall on Cornelius and he's like, I didn't see that coming, but it did. And I can no longer withhold. I can no longer withhold from others what God has given to me because God has affirmed them too. Those moments of mind change for me have never been just about strictly studying. It has been a human experience that caused me to go back and realize that I had misread, misunderstood, misinterpreted, just plain missed it. And that the Jesus response was not to double down, but it was to fall down weeping if necessary, repentant, yes, and change the way I thought. It's what should have happened in Oklahoma this week. It's what should have happened in Oklahoma this week instead of doubling down on bigotry and hate. What an interesting story. Would you agree? Now, we're not done. Because what Mark does in Mark's own brilliant way is the payoff is always later. So there's a story next about Jesus healing, restoring hearing to a deaf man, and that's a really fascinating story. But then, at the beginning of chapter 8, and we'll be in chapter 8 next week, but at the beginning of chapter 8, there's another story of another mass feeding. And this time it's Jesus feeding a group of Gentiles. You know, a couple chapters ago, Jesus feeds 5,000 Jewish people and they pick up how many basketfuls? 12. And 12 is really symbolic, right? It represents Israel. Jesus is reconstituting Israel because this is our thing. And now he goes to some Gentiles and he says to his disciples, look, these folks have been with us for days and they're hungry. If we send them home, they'll pass out. They need food. And the disciples are like, we can't help them. And I just imagine in Mark's narrative, if Jesus wanted to go, were you around two chapters ago or three, whatever it was? You remember what happened? We were like, I don't know what to do. And he's like, get everybody to sit in groups and then see what you've got available and start passing it out. And it happens again. He gets them in groups. It's called community organizing. They take 7 loaves of bread and some fishes. They start passing them around. Everybody eats and is satisfied. And then they start picking up the leftovers. And this is where verse 8 gets interesting. By the way, I wonder if they did the thing my family does with leftovers generally, which is either forget them on the table or put them in the refrigerator and wait until you could probably cure something with it. to realize it's in there. But they pick up the basketfuls. Everybody ate and was filled. They took up broken pieces and left over. How many baskets?
Seven.
Now, I've always struggled. 12 makes sense. Israel, seven. And when you read commentaries, a lot of times they'll say, well, seven is a number of completeness. Thanks. What does it mean? Complete what? Complete for what? I struggled with that for a long time. Like 12 makes sense. 12 has a meaning. Seven has to have a meaning. And it just so happened one day to be reading, like you do, the book of Deuteronomy. I don't know how many of you just do that for fun. I wonder what's happening in Deuteronomy today. And here's what happens in chapter 7. They are being given instructions. Moses is being given, in Deuteronomy, it's usually God speaking to Moses. They're being given instructions on what to do when they get to the land of Canaan, because they have been liberated from enslavement in Egypt. They have wandered in the wilderness for 40 years, and they're on the verge of going into the promised land. The problem is the promised land is occupied. It's already somebody else's promised land. So they're going to have to displace all the people there to take it. And when they get to the promised land, they're given some specific instructions. The guy in charge of this conquest campaign is a guy named Joshua. It's a name I have an affinity for. And Joshua is going to lead the campaign to take the land because God told them to. Other countries in human history have done this too, unfortunately. And here's what happens. Verse 1, chapter 7. When the Lord your God brings you into the land that you're about to enter and occupy, and he clears away many nations before you, the Hittites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, the Jebusites. How many nations? Seven nations, more numerous and mightier than you. When the Lord your God gives them over to you and you defeat them, you must utterly destroy them, make no covenant with them, and show them no what? Interesting Bible text. Remember what Matthew does with the Syrophoenician woman? What's he change her to? Canaanite. Like Matthew's like, I'm afraid they're going to read Mark and they're going to think something else. I want them to get it. You know what I think is happening in this story? By the way, the idea of utterly destroying, it's the Hebrew word harem. And what it essentially means is that, this is not just an idea within the Bible. This other surrounding regions practice this too. They had this idea. It often gets translated as putting them under the ban. And what this would mean is when you would go into war with somebody, you would totally annihilate everything with breath. Men, women, children, infants, the elderly, you would kill animals, everything. You would go in a village, a town, whatever, you would wipe everything with breath out, and you wouldn't even take spoils of war, you would burn it all down. And this is not just an act of war, this is an act, you're essentially turning them all into sacrifices to your God. So you're committing this atrocious act of genocide as an act of worship. And that's what they're being called to do here in this text. Go into the land of Canaan, and devote every person you meet, everything with breath, to God. Show them no mercy, make no deals, kill them all. What was the name of the person in charge of that work? Joshua. Well, fun fact, Jesus is a Greek rendering of the Hebrew name Joshua. It's as if what Mark is saying is there is a Joshua 2.0 on the scene. And what we have learned from him is that he is not leading a new conquest. He is not leading a nationalist conquest. He's not killing those who are different than him. He is leading a campaign of liberation and healing. And he is feeding the hungry among them. He is not hurting the Canaanites. He is caring for the Canaanites because he sees the image of God in them too. You see why it's one of my favorite stories? Y'all, I think Jesus gives us a gift. Because what Jesus does in this story is the thing that Christianity has tried to stop people from doing for 2,000 years. He changes his mind. He has an experience of another human being, meets God face to face in them. And he changes his mind. He throws a wineskin to the side of the road and picks up a new one because he knows that whatever he's carrying, whatever the work he's been given to do, cannot be contained in the wineskins of the old. It continually has to be updated, refreshed, made new. I think what this also means is that when we come across a doctrine, we come across a doctrine, and we have to turn God into a monster to defend it, it is a bad doctrine, and it should be let go of. And I think what else this means is that the most important question we can ask about a doctrine, a dogma, a belief, is not what does the Bible say, because the Bible says a lot. It is, what is the human impact of this doctrine, dogma, or belief? Because I do not care what is in the text if it hurts people. Commands about how to treat your enemies where you show no mercy are in the text. And also Joshua 2.0, undoing the conquest narrative and setting out a different vision that the church has failed and failed and failed and failed to follow is also in the text. What is the human impact of our beliefs? And I think that is where we meet Jesus, willing to let go of long, hard, strong-held beliefs because he met God in someone else. May we do the same.